It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, Mara Wilson, the young actor who was in the movie Matilda and Mrs. Doubtfire, talks to us about life as a child actor and life after the spotlight. First, the Department of Corrections and several other state agencies released a new biennial budget report on Friday. The DOC asked for almost $3 million to face problems at Wisconsin's youth prisons, Lincoln Hill School for Boys and Copper Lake School for Girls. The state's youth prison is the subject of an ongoing investigation after allegations of sexual assault and abuse. Molly Beck joins us now. She covers politics and state government for the Wisconsin State Journal. Molly, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, again, the DOC is asking for $3 million to address some of the problems at Copper Lake and Lincoln Hills, rather. What have they said about what the money would go for?
Sure. If you've been reading any newspaper in the last 20 months, or not 20 months, but a few months, there's been a 20-month-long investigation at the state's youth prison in Irma, Wisconsin. And that investigation is looking at allegations of abuse of inmates and official misconduct and sexual assault and a wide range of potential crimes there. And this $3 million that a colleague of mine and I wrote about on Friday would address a couple of those issues that they're investigating that's been going on for 20 months. And one of them is, apparently so far, or up until recently, medical staff have not been handing out medication to the inmates there, and it's been, that task has fallen to the guards there, essentially. And because of that, according to the budget request, there's been medication errors. And it's unclear if, those errors have been significant and dangerous, for the inmates' health. That's not clear, but obviously they're taking this money and they're going to hire at least 9 more staff members that are, trained in the medical field. And so nurses and doctors, they would be the only kind of staff that would be handing out medication to the inmates there. And then another chunk of money that they're asking for is to hire more staff just to ensure that the risk of sexual assault is lessened, which is something that a federal law requires detention facilities to do.
Now, going back to that first point, having medical staff dispense medication instead of the security staff, what goes as the best practice nationally? Do we know?
Sure. According to the secretary, John Litcher, he was appointed by Governor Walker a few months ago. The best practice at the national level, according to Litcher, is that non-healthcare staff is unsafe. And he, in this budget request, he called what has been happening there a not acceptable practice. They're not trained or experienced in medication delivery, and they also don't hold what he called the fundamental knowledge of the safe and correct methods of administration of medication. So what he wants to do is to ensure that if anybody's handing out medication at that facility, it's somebody that's, been trained in the medical field to make sure, or to at least lessen the likelihood of errors occurring.
Now, and as you said, Lincoln Hills also wants to be more compliant with the Federal Prison Rape Elimination Act. Can you tell us, looking back, what kinds of problems Lincoln Hills has had with sexual assault allegations?
Sure. There have been some allegations of inmates sexually assaulting each other. There have been allegations of staff sexually assaulting inmates. And it's unclear whether those allegations will prove to be true, if any charges will be brought as a result of those allegations. But there were a number of stories like that throughout that investigation. And I actually visited some staff there, and they said that they had heard this was happening and it's been going on for a while. It's not something new. So those allegations are not new. And so, but on top of that, the detention facilities have to comply with this federal law that sets staffing level standards to reduce the risk of sexual assault occurring. And some of those standards are you must have this number of staff just around just to watch what's going on. Some, you know, standards say that you can't have an adult alone with a juvenile inmate alone. You know, there has to be someone else there too. So they're working toward complying with that federal law. This budget request won't, you know, fulfill what they need to be compliant. They need 57 more positions, and they're not even asking for half that. It's unclear why they're not asking for the full 57 in this budget request.
Right. You reported they're asking for 8. So did they have any comment about why they're just asking for enough money to hire 8 instead of the full 57 to be compliant?
Yeah, I asked that a few times, and the response I got each time I asked was that they're working toward becoming compliant. They don't actually have to meet that standard until next year. So I'm not sure if that means they're going to be asking for more later on the line. I'm not sure if that means they're anticipating some sort of reorganization. It's unclear at this point why they're not just asking for that full 57 to be compliant with that law.
And what do we know about how this budget request has been received so far?
I think, you know, I haven't heard any pushback on it. I know that Governor Walker's office said that they want to make sure that, you know, sexual assaults are obviously not happening there, and that the medication administration is, you know, how it should be, you know, handled how it should be. So it's not clear. The full budget request from the Department of Corrections is $2.5 billion, so this is just a small part of that. And that represents about a 5% increase in spending. So we'll see if this will be a tight year type budget process. So we'll see if they can get what they're asking for here.
And Molly, as we wrap up, you looked at requests and budgets from other agencies, other parts of the government. What did you find people are looking for?
Sure. The Department of Natural Resources, they're proposing about a 2% funding cut. I know that the Department of Health Services, they're seeking a 5% funding increase to $24.4 billion. And much of that increase is coming from about a $450 million increase from the state's general fund for Medicaid. And in our story, we also looked at the University of Wisconsin system and the Wisconsin Technical College system, and they're both asking for additional money. The UW system is asking for $42 million over 2 years, and that the tech college system is seeking about $20 million in new state funding.
And lastly, circling back to Lincoln Hills, you said we're in the midst of a 20-month investigation. What's the next move here? What are we looking for?
Right. I think we're waiting. It's in the hands of the FBI at this point, and they're reviewing everything. I know that they did interviews with basically everybody that worked there, and they're you know, reviewing everything that they have. I just checked in with them recently, and they didn't have an update for when that might close. But
we'll keep watching.
We're waiting.
Molly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Molly Beck. She covers politics and state government for the Wisconsin State Journal. And she talked to us about Wisconsin's Department of Corrections seeking $3 million to face problems at the state's youth prisons. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the U.S. Census released new data that shows household incomes in the country are rising. We'll talk about what that means for Wisconsin and for the economy. First, depending on when you were born, you may remember watching movies like Matilda or Mrs. Doubtfire with your kids, or you may remember watching it as a kid yourself. Well, Mara Wilson was the little girl with starring roles in both of those movies.
Where'd all this come from?
A library.
The library? You've never set foot in a library. You're only 4 years old.
Six and a half.
You're four.
Six and a half.
If you were six and a half, you'd be in school already.
I want to be in school. I told you I was supposed to start school in September. You wouldn't listen.
Get up. Get up. Get out here. Give me that book. Here's Pi. How old is Matilda?
Four.
I'm six and a half, Mommy.
Five, then.
It was 6 in August.
You're a liar.
I want to go to school.
School? It's out of the question. Who would be here to sign for the packages? We can't leave valuable packages sitting out on the doorstep. Now go watch TV like a good kid.
Now an adult, the former child actress wrote a memoir about going from fame to what she calls relative but happy obscurity. Her book, Where Am I Now? True Stories of Girlhood and Accidental Fame, is out now and looks back at the unique experience of being a child star and also details the more common one of just being a kid and coming of age. Mara Wilson joins us now to tell us about her new book. Mara, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, when you look back on your childhood, how out of the ordinary do you think it was compared to other kids?
I think that it was very unusual, but I think it took me a long time to realize just how unusual it was. My parents tried very hard to keep me grounded and to keep me living the same, you know, lower middle class existence that I lived for the rest of my life. You know, I had a shared room with my little sister. I still went to public school for most of my life. I went to Girl Scouts. I did things like that. And it was very important to them that I keep it that way. And so I think it really took me a while to realize that, you know, I knew that people were recognizing me all the time. But also, I went to school with a bunch of child actors. And they were all, you know, there were people on Seventh Heaven. There were people doing commercials. A lot of my best friends were child actors. My first boyfriend was a child actor. So it was kind of part of the culture of L.A. where I grew up in the Valley. It was just kind of something that we did the same way that, you know, kids in Texas play, I don't know, play football or something like that. You know, kids in Canada play hockey. It was just part of the thing that we did. So I think it wasn't until I got much older that I realized that I had an impact and a positive impact at that.
And one thing that did seem pretty out of the ordinary was the way you're very open about your fears and your anxieties and your neuroses. And you spend a chunk of time, especially in the beginning, talking about how when you were a kid, well, actually, probably till you were in your preteens, early teens, you were preoccupied with death, which seems really at odds with this optimistic, spunky little girl that we know you for from your early roles. What was that like?
Yeah, I was a pretty dark kid. I mean, I was very extroverted, and I was very, you know, and my family says that I was a very, you know, sweet and well-behaved kid, but I was just obsessed with death, and I had all these really dark moments, even though, you know, I was living a pretty happy life. So I don't know where that comes from. I just think that that's, you know, kind of who I was. Eventually, you know, my mother got sick and died, and that was very hard for me, and that definitely exacerbated things. But I think that it was just kind of the way that I was. I think that a lot of children are very dark. A lot of children go through a dark phase, and, you know, it's whether, depending on their life, you know, if they live a good, happy life, or if they have something, you know, sad happen to them, that can definitely affect their outlook.
It sounds like your mom was a really grounding force while you were being a child actor. And you tell this great story in the book about how you learned pretty young what sex was, and you could not contain it. You had this knowledge bomb, and it was going to go off, and it did. Can you tell us that story?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that was one of the most embarrassing moments of my life. When I was a kid, I would lay awake at night. Yeah, when I was a kid, I would lie awake at night thinking, did anybody remember that? Does anybody remember that? So my mother taught me about sex a little bit by showing me like a special, I think, on PBS or something, and then explaining to me, you know, what these kids were doing. And so then I went the next day to the set, and I knew that there was like, it was this big secret, but I started asking people, like I asked one of the hair and makeup women if she knew about sex and if she'd done it. And it was, I just started singing, I know about sex, I know about sex. And I looked over at my mother, and my mother was furious with me, just so mad at me. But fortunately, Robin Williams and Chris Columbus came over, and they were just laughing about it because, you know, they knew that I was a kid, and they knew that kids made these kinds of mistakes. So it was, you know, just kind of acceptable for them. And I think because of them, I avoided getting in major trouble.
I want to talk about what it was like being thinking about how you looked when you were that age, because at a certain point you talk about you go to Japan And you discover people there think you're really cute, and that makes you feel good. But later on, that emphasis on looks sort of turns on you. You're not cute enough for Hollywood anymore. So how did that impact the way you saw yourself and your self-esteem?
It definitely affected me. I mean, when I was very young, I think it was just sort of like, I didn't really like being told I was cute all the time, because it felt a little bit like, you know, when your mom's friends get together and they say, oh, I remember when you were this big, you know, it makes you feel that big or that small again, you know, it makes you feel childish. And so I didn't like that. But then when I went through puberty, I lost a superpower I didn't even know I had. You know, I thought that I... And it definitely stuck with me for a very long time, because I knew that I wasn't attractive enough for Hollywood. So I think there was a part of me that thought that I just wasn't attractive, period. There was nothing attractive about me at all, that I was hideous. But I think that, you know, I've come to accept that, you know, I have my assets and flaws like everybody else. And, you know, just because you're not attractive enough for Hollywood doesn't mean that there's, like, anything wrong with you. And it really made me realize how much emphasis we put on looks and how ridiculous it is that we put emphasis on looks in everyday life.
I'm thinking about child actors, the actors who played Punky Brewster or Macaulay Culkin or Anthony Michael Hall. And it seems like in some cases it can be hard to emerge as an intact adult after you've been a big child star. Do you know how you did it?
I think that really what helped me was that I had other interests. I had other things I wanted to do. I had other pursuits, you know. I studied improv comedy, and I was in choir, and I did drama. So stage acting and performing was something that I really loved, too. And I also always knew that I loved writing. I wanted to be a writer from when I was really little. And so writing was something that definitely kept me going. I think that I had a family that loved me and supported me no matter what. And, you know, I always felt like I had their support and their care and their love. I mean, therapy also didn't hurt. I think that, you know, it was a combination of things. But I think that also my parents never pushed me into acting. So when I said, and they weren't living off my money, so when I said that I didn't want to act anymore, or, you know, actually it was my father who said, you know, maybe take some time off right now, I was okay with it. And they were okay with it as well.
We're talking with Mara Wilson right now, writer, playwright, actor, and storyteller, and probably best known for her roles in Mrs. Doubtfire, Matilda, Miracle on 34th Street. Her new book is called Where Am I Now? True Stories of Girlhood and Accidental Fame. And you write in several places in your book about Robin Williams. And, of course, he was on set with you in Mrs. Doubtfire. You knew him when you were pretty young, and then a little bit later on in What Dreams May Come. What was he like to you? What was your relationship?
Oh, he was just the kindest, gentlest guy. He was so fatherly. And, you know, he has a lot of, you know, inappropriate material when he does stand-up. But with kids, he is never inappropriate at all. He's always telling jokes that he knew we thought would be funny. He, you know, he listened to us, and that was really nice. He talked to us like we were people. He respected us like we were people. And so he was a lot of fun, although my mother always said that he was very quiet when he was talking with adults. She pointed out that he was very quiet with adults, but he definitely came alive when he was with kids and definitely came alive when he had an audience.
I noticed you started out talking about him in the present tense, and then you switched to past tense. Is he someone who still seems present in your life?
Well, I just think that he was such, you know, I never imagined that we would lose him. He does seem like he is just such this large presence, and somebody, I think when you affect somebody at a young age in a positive way, you're going to stick with them for the rest of their life. And I think that that's definitely what it was for me. He was, you know, he was kind of like a favorite teacher. And so to me, there is this thing that lives on, you know, there is this part of him that definitely lives on.
And he was an actor, a comedian, and storyteller. He created these stories on the spot. And I notice, you know, you're doing storytelling now, too. This is something you've really always wanted to do.
Yeah, for sure.
How did you make that bridge from child actor to storyteller?
Well, I always wanted to tell stories. That was what I hoped that, you know, people could do, because I just loved standing up and performing stories that I made up and, you know, stories about my life from when I was a kid. And I did well whenever I had to write about my own life. And I did well in that. I did well with that in college. And so I started focusing on that in college. I took an autobiography writing class, and it was something that people were suddenly interested in hearing about, especially considering since I'd had an interesting life. So I think my sophomore year of college, I did a piece about my relationship with my father, and it really seemed to resonate with so many people, which was surprising to me, because I thought the details were very specific to my relationship, but it turns out the more personal you get with storytelling, the more universal it is. So I started focusing on that, and then my senior year, I did a show called Weren't You That Girl? That was all about my child acting, and that went over extremely well. And I started looking into it, and what I learned was that there was this big storytelling scene in New York City. I mean, you've heard of The Moth, but there was also shows like Risk and Bear and all kinds of things where people were just telling stories on stage. And the stories, you know, had to be fully formed. They couldn't just be anecdotes. They had to be interesting. And they were. And I started going to these shows, and I started performing at them, and I kind of learned by doing, although there are definitely storytelling classes you can take. And so I learned by doing. And that is really how I started getting some of the stories for this book as well.
Mara, you're very upfront about your anxiety, like we were talking about earlier. And as we wrap up, what advice do you have for someone who wants to uncover, as you would say, their inner badass and get out there and tell their stories?
And tell their stories? I think you have to be, you know, it's okay to make mistakes, and tell yourself that it's okay to make mistakes. I think that is the most important thing to remember. And I wish that I had taken that to heart when I was a child.
Mara, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Mara Wilson. She's best known for her roles as the little girl from Mrs. Doubtfire, Matilda, and Miracle on 34th Street. Her most recent book is called Where Am I Now? True Stories of Girlhood and Accidental Fame. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about rising household incomes in the United States and how some Wisconsin municipalities are still lagging behind the nation. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, UW-Platteville hosted a policing conference featuring national guests and local activists last Friday. We'll talk to a reporter who covered that conference to get the details. First, new census data released last week shows that household incomes in 2015 rose by more than 5% for the first time since 2007. But while Wisconsin has aligned for the most part with the national average, there are still municipalities struggling with static poverty rates, including the state's most populous city, Milwaukee. Joining us now to talk about household incomes is Steve Deller. He is a professor of agricultural and applied economics at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, let's look back at those national numbers. 5.2% may not sound like a lot, but what does this mean for people?
Actually, this is a reversal of a long-term trend. Essentially, since the Great Recession started, incomes really haven't been growing that much, particularly when you take into the effects of inflation. If you factor in inflation, this is the first real strong growth that we've had in almost 10 years. So this is a very good sign.
So this is, we're talking before the recession started.
Yeah, there was, at the U.S. level, there was modest growth from about 2003 to 2004. six thereabouts, there was modest growth. And then the Great Recession hit, and it just kind of it bottomed out. And the recovery has been painfully slow. But these last numbers are really kind of showing that the economy started to pick up some speed.
So that means, would you call this a strong trend, a strong indicator?
Well, it's difficult to kind of say if this is a long-term trend or a one-year blip in the data. Generally, you like to see things moving in the same direction three periods in a row. But since this is annual data, it's kind of, you know, waiting 3 years to see if this is a trend or not is really not very satisfactory. I would think that given current behavior, I think that this is the start of a positive trend upward.
What do you think is fueling that rebound?
I think a lot of it has to do with the jobs market. We've had a record number of months in a row that we've been seeing job growth. And when you see job growth like that, you start to see pressure on the available supply of labor. And when you see that, employers start to bid up wages to try to attract employees. And when they bid up wages, that's going to transfer into, you know, stronger household income.
Now, is there any way looking forward, as you said, you need maybe three data points to know if we're talking about a trend right now or a blip, but are there indications right now that the jobs that we're seeing and the incomes that are rising, is this the sort of the makings of a durable sort of future for incomes?
Well, again, this is the economy is really kind of generating jobs at two levels. One is low skill, low education level jobs. And there's a lot being generated at that level. The other end is the higher end. And what's happening is that those jobs kind of in the middle of this distribution, those are where we're not seeing growth. So, it depends on which one of those two are going to dominate. I think we're seeing some upward pressure on those low-income jobs because it's simply, employers are finding that they have to pay a little bit more. So I think I think if the continued trend goes the way it is, I think we're looking at good times.
And looking nationwide again, where are we in terms of unemployment?
Unemployment, Wisconsin has been doing fairly well on unemployment. Economists will always be debating about what is the optimal level of unemployment. We'll always have some unemployment because there's always a churn in the economy. People are leaving jobs, businesses start and close and whatnot. Some economists say that it's 4% would be a healthy unemployment rate. Some say no, 3.5%. When you start to get unemployment rates down around 2%, like you see in Madison and Dane County oftentimes, that's where you can really say that there's a serious labor shortage.
And I want to look closer to home now in Wisconsin and focus our lens there. So looking at trends in household incomes in Wisconsin, how does it look?
Well, again, the last year and this year is an upward tick. Again, I think it's starting to reflect kind of what's happening nationally. But for Wisconsin, real median household income has been declining since 2006. Indeed, it's the peak median household income was about $65,000 in 1999, and now we're only at $55,600. So there's a gap of over $9,000 between the peak in 1999 and today. So we have, this is a good sign, but we still have a lot to work on.
So what areas do you think we need to be looking at to make up that gap?
I think that we need to start moving our thinking of in terms of what does the economy of tomorrow look like. I think too often we tend to look at what our economy was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and we want to try to rebuild that. And you can think of it in terms of kind of the old strong legacy industries of the state of Wisconsin, food processing, paper, manufacturing, things like that. I think in order to kind of revive income growth in the state, we need to start thinking about what is the economy of the future. Looking at software development, biotechnology development, and investing in human capital that will kind of spur that type of investment.
Is that the story in other parts of the country where we are seeing maybe more robust growth in the economy, that they are looking at not the past economy before the recession, but what comes next?
Yes. Education policy, I mean, one of the ways that we influence economic development in the strongest ways related to education policy. And we can do it in one of two ways. One is to kind of, what are the immediate needs? What do we need right now? And invest in providing those types of workers. The other is to say, well, what is the economy going to look like 5, 10, 15 years from now? And we need to invest in education in order to kind of push that type of development. I think Wisconsin has been falling. Wisconsin historically always been looking forward. You know, what's the economy going to be 10 years from now? How do we make investments now? I think over the past 10 years or so, we've kind of slid backwards a little bit. And I think we're more focused on what are the immediate needs as opposed to what are the needs of the future.
We're talking with Steve Deller right now, professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison, talking about news showing that household incomes are on the rise for the first time in nearly 8 years. And, Stephen, how do you do what you just talked about? It sounds like a tough trick to be focused on what is ahead instead of the urgencies that are right before you on your plate and solving those problems first. How do you make that shift?
It's easier said than done. I'll be perfectly honest. But I think it is creating opportunities for people to kind of make these decisions on their own. I think a lot of it is to encourage youth to kind of explore their career opportunities. What do they want to do when they grow up? And right now, the tone has been really kind of looking at immediate employment opportunities, kind of what are the legacy industries looking at, as opposed to kind of pushing yourself a little bit further into some of these other types of industries that will be growing. So is the labor supply responding to the demand, or is the labor supply kind of shifting and changing the way that we think about what the economy will be?
Now let's talk about Milwaukee, Wisconsin's biggest city, and get a handle on what's happening there. The picture a little more complicated. What do you see when you look at the economic picture in Milwaukee?
Milwaukee is, well, if we're talking about the city of Milwaukee, or are we talking about the metropolitan area?
Let's talk both.
Well, there's a big difference. Because if you look at some of the richest counties in Wisconsin, riches in terms of, you know, median household income, you got Osage County and Waukesha County and Washington County. They're all right there. And Jefferson County now is becoming part of that. They're some of the richest. But, you know, Milwaukee County is one of the lowest outside of the rural, really rural areas. Indeed, if you look at some of the fastest growth counties, Osage County had some of the fastest growth. Jefferson County had some of the fastest growth. Milwaukee County actually had a growth of about $3,000 in median household income, which is a positive sign. So Milwaukee, the city itself, has several issues that it has to deal with. But the metropolitan area is doing okay. So you kind of have this region of suburban areas that are doing fine. They're not busting the doors down by any means. But then you've got this center of Milwaukee that's kind of holding the area down.
And you've got, it looks like, some pretty static poverty rates in the city of Milwaukee. What do you see there?
They're not really, I mean, the poverty rates in Milwaukee really aren't changing that much from one year to the next. I mean, they're pretty flat. But you are seeing some growth, particularly on the south side of the city. And there's been some new reinvestment in manufacturing in the area. So I'm not ready to say that Milwaukee's turned the corner, but there is some positive indications that are going on there.
Steve Deller is with us right now talking about recent census numbers showing that household incomes are on the rise for the first time in nearly 8 years. And we want to hear from you on this. If you were affected by the Great Recession, have you noticed your income improving? What would you like to see change if you are still feeling that pinch from the Great Recession? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up that conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. And if you're just joining us now, we're talking about census data released last week that shows household incomes are on the rise for the first time since 2007. And we want to hear from you on this. Do you feel as though your own income has improved since the beginning of the Great Recession? Or do you feel like you're still recovering? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Are things better for you and for your family? You can also leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. Steve Deller stays with us. He's a professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. And Steve, when you look at areas of growth in the city of Milwaukee, you just pointed out a couple of bright spots that have the potential to be job creators. One of them that you named is manufacturing. And manufacturing, I think, is an example of the old economy of Milwaukee, not the new. Are you also seeing that new economy you were talking about?
A little bit. That's taking place more in the suburbs than in the city of Milwaukee, a little bit. And when I say that, you know, the legacy economy, that we focus too much on the legacy economy, I'm not saying that we should throw it out, that we should ignore it. I mean, we do have a comparative advantage in manufacturing, particularly small-scale, flexible manufacturing. That's something that we shouldn't just say, okay, well, we're going to wash our hands of manufacturing and walk away from it. That would be a mistake. I think the question is, what's the proper balance between trying to nurture and retain the legacy industry of manufacturing and looking to the future? What is that proper balance? And I'm thinking that in Wisconsin right now, that thought process is a little out of balance.
I want to ask you, this morning in our editorial meeting, we were talking about the role of the economy in the conversation around the presidential race. I think there was a clip of Bill Clinton talking with a gentleman who was working in a deli, and he said that the man in the deli said he's not hearing enough about the economy, and that's what matters to him is the economy. Do you think we're hearing enough about it?
No. I hear about it all the time because that's what I listen for. But I would imagine that the current presidential debate is really kind of unique. I think we're on new territory here in terms of how that discussion is going forward. I think that rather than having a debate about policy issues and essentially saying what are the issues that we're dealing with, we're listening to sound bites. And we can't really have a legitimate conversation about the economy and security and the future of the country through sound bites. And I would agree with that deli owner that we're missing an opportunity to have a more important conversation.
So we've got the debates coming up in, I guess, a week or two. If you could write a question or two for the candidates, what do you want to know about how they would handle the economy?
I guess it would be to Trump, because if you look at what his policies are, it's essentially good old-fashioned supply-side trickle-down economics. Cut taxes dramatically and increase defense spending. We've tried that. It doesn't work. We've tried it numerous times. You can look at what's happening to Kansas, and it's not working. Essentially, what it's going to do is going to explode the deficit, which is not so much the deficit in and of itself isn't that bad. The problem is who's funding the deficit, who's buying those government treasury notes, and it was Japan. Now it's China. I mean, do we really want China to own essentially the banker of the U.S. because of the deficits we're running? I think that that's a strategic issue that we should be talked about, but we're not. So I think it would be more, we've tried that in history. We've tried supply-side economics, and history has shown that it doesn't work. Why you continue to promote it?
Let's take a caller now as we continue our conversation with Steve Deller from UW-Madison, looking at some rising income levels in Wisconsin, also some poverty rates in Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee, that are not moving, and wondering if you feel more prosperous right now, and also if you think we're talking about the economy enough during this presidential election season. We have Mike on the line. You can join in, too. The number 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. And Mike is next in Madison. Mike, hi.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Steve. I really think we need a big shift in the economy, and we need to consider the environment as well. And right now we have a lot of big businesses that are polluting the commons with airlines, a lot of individuals driving too much with gas hogs. We have to find a way to pay people who pollute less and therefore add to their incomes. And people in Milwaukee who don't do those things, basically, would get subsidized to some degree, but they also would be rewarded for not polluting our environment the way everybody else is. Climate change.
Mike, thanks a lot for those comments. Mike wanting a way to incentivize the green economy and build from there, partially. What do you say to Mike?
Actually, I think it's a very good point because, again, a lot of our legacy industries are not necessarily environmentally friendly. They're working on trying to make it more friendly. You look at a lot of the agriculture, they're trying to adopt new technologies to minimize the environmental impact. But a lot of our legacy industries do have a negative impact on the environment. Now, you flip that around and you say, well, what about the economy of the future? If you want to go so far as to say, you know, what are we going to draw? How are we going to attract the creative class, if use that phrase. The research suggests that a lot of those folks really are looking for high quality of life places to live. They want clean environment. They want recreation. They want cultural events. They want, things that you think of when you think about a high quality of life. Those folks want to live in those kind of places. And then the businesses are spurred after that. So you kind of, you flip the causation there a little bit. Rather than the businesses driving it, it's really kind of the people that are driving it. It used to be for years we would think that, you know, people follow jobs. Well, it's kind of changed now, particularly with the future economy. It's going to be jobs follow people. And where do people want to locate? They want to live in high quality of life places. Now, when you define quality of life, it's going to be different. I mean, some people would think downtown Chicago is high quality of life because that's what they like. Other people think that would be, you know, a hell sentence. So it's really difficult. But things like clean environment, I think we can all agree on that.
And we've focused in on Wisconsin as a whole and also Milwaukee and the suburbs around Milwaukee. What about rural areas of the state?
The rural areas are struggling a little bit right now. They're struggling really for a couple of reasons. One is the ag economy is really going through a tough period right now. We went through record commodity prices a few years back, and now we're looking at record low commodity prices. So agriculture is kind of in a tough spot right now. The other thing is that tourism is down a little bit. And what we're seeing is that rural areas are simply not experiencing the recovery that a lot of the urban areas are. Are they declining? They're stagnant.
And that may be a hard sell to the creative class you're talking about. Probably that set of people wants to live in an urban area. And if you're talking about a new economy versus the legacy economy, probably in rural Wisconsin, you're talking more about the legacy economy and agriculture. So what do you do? What policies do you put in place to help folks in rural parts of the state?
There is one community in Door County that we were working with, the university were working with, and they wanted to try to, a very pretty place on Lake Michigan, Bailey's Harbor, and they wanted to try to promote more of a year-round economy away from that seasonal economy. And one of the things they wanted to try to do was to promote more home-based businesses where you would get millennials and this creative class that want to live in a high amenity area like that and work out of their home. In order for that to happen, you've got to have broadband, reliable broadband, and they don't have it. So it's this complex puzzle where there's a lot of pieces that are moving around. And one of the pieces that is missing for a lot of rural Wisconsin is access to quality broadband.
And Steve, just briefly, as we wrap up, what markers are you going to be looking for to see whether or not this recovery is going to keep going and whether it's going to keep going for Wisconsin?
I would look at really the kind of the poverty rates. I think that's a big one. The other big one is what's happening to the housing market. A lot of economists, if you want one simple leading indicator of what's happening to the local economy, the community, it's what's happening to the housing market. Go talk to the real estate agents, and they will give you a very clear answer on what's happening. I'd focus on poverty, but more directly, what's happening to the real estate market.
Steve, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Stephen Deller, professor of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison, talking about a Census Bureau report showing that household incomes rose in 2015 for the first time since the Great Recession. This is Central Time. The Emmy Awards were last night. I watched them on Twitter. I guess I kind of read them, which was a lot less time consuming. The takeaways, Game of Thrones won Best Drama Series, Veep won Best Comedy Series, and a big surprise, this guy didn't win anything, but apparently he's not letting that get him down. Here's host Jimmy Kimmel trying to hitch a ride to the Emmys in Julia Louise Dreyfus's car, driven by Jeb Bush.
I'm in between jobs right now. You know you can make $12 an hour driving for Uber?
I did not know that, but that's great. I have to get downtown to the Emmys.
Are you nominated?
I am, yeah.
Wow. What's that like?
It's nice. It's nice.
You think you can win?
Well, there's a lot of competition, and probably not.
Well, here's what I know. If you run a positive campaign, the voters ultimately will make the right choice.
You know, it's funny you say that. My psychic...
Jimmy... That was a joke. Get out of the car. And shave that wig off your face, you godless Hollywood hippie.
Jeb Bush finding his funny in a sketch from the Emmys last night. Nice that he doesn't sound bitter. Well, too bitter anyway. This is Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Stay tuned. There's more to come.